This is Family-Based Youth Ministry Course, Tape 2, Side B. A few thoughts as we begin talking about Family-Based Youth Ministry and the vision. Again, just a few brain ticklers to get you thinking. John Westerhoff says in Will Our Children Have Faith? This is back in, I think it was the 1970s that he wrote this. I am convinced that the very foundations upon which we engage in Christian education are shaking. And while a host of builders attempt with varying degrees of success to shore them up, there is a dearth of architects engaged in building and designing new structures. The church's educational problem rests not in its educational program, but in the paradigm or model which undergirds its educational ministry, the agreed-upon frame of reference which guides its educational efforts. And then I love this quote from C.S. Lewis from The Problem of Pain. He says, "I take a very low view of climates of opinion. In his own subject, every man knows that all discoveries are made and all errors corrected by those who ignore the, quote, climates of opinion." And then Tim Smith, a youth worker and author, says, "Successful youth ministry in this area certainly doesn't require bigger and better programs. Rather, kids are looking for simplicity and effectiveness. Instead of building a Rolls Royce with all the amenities, we need to build a simple Jeep, rugged, durable, and flexible." And then I love this. He says, "Your most effective planning tool may be your eraser." Then Mark Sinner, who we've talked about recently in the first tape, I believe, in his book, The Coming Revolution of Youth Ministry, he says this: "The day of the broadcast is over. Narrowcasting has become essential for radio and television to survive. The day of youth ministry broadcasting is over as well." And finally, Edwin Freeman, in his family systems book called Generation to Generation, he says, "When one part of an organism is treated in isolation from its interconnections with another, as though the problem were solely its own, fundamental change is not likely. The symptom is apt to recycle in the same or a different form, in the same or different member. Trying to cure a person in isolation from his or her family is as misdirected and ultimately ineffective as transplanting a healthy organ into a body whose imbalanced chemistry will destroy the new one as it did the old. It is easy to forget the same family of organs that rejected a transplant contributed to the original disease part becoming foreign." Wow. Well, as I looked at the crisis in our culture facing our kids, I knew that having a traditional youth program, the way it's always been done, every Sunday night, plain old vanilla youth program, was just not going to cut it anymore. I didn't quite know what was, but I knew that something had to be different. So I began fishing. And so I want to tell a bit of the story of what happened here in Nashville, and then create for you at least an introductory model, a foundational sort of approach to looking at family-based youth ministry. When I came to First Presbyterian Nashville 7 years ago, I inherited a small but strong Sunday night program, a core group of youth who came fairly regularly and who seemed to love being together. Most of this core group went to the same school, same two schools, a boys' school and a girls' school. Actually, since one of these schools was only for boys and the other for girls, the students from the two schools shared almost identical social circles. I soon realized that despite the homogeneous nature of the active group, there were young people from 21 other schools on the church rolls. So naturally, my first plan was to try to expand the Sunday night program so that it included teenagers from as many different schools as possible. I worked with our volunteer leaders to come up with fun, exciting programs for each week. And after 6 months or so of diligent planning and work, the group had grown from about 30 to an average of almost 32. Although different youth were coming, I'd simply exchanged an old guard for a new guard. The Sunday night program seemed to be going nowhere. So with a passion, I began trying new program after new program. I read the youth ministry books and I listened to the youth ministry tapes, and every time I heard a new idea, I'd try it. But it seemed like every new program seemed to hit the same ceiling. Whether we were only having fun or having more diligent Bible study or doing service projects or having student leadership programs or doing some combination of the three or four, the group would settle into a ho-hum pattern that seemed to be going nowhere. As I tried to keep the Sunday night program alive, I began to see the need for discipleship groups for young people who wanted to go deeper than we could give at Sunday school or youth group. So we created what I called house groups, which met for a year. The young people involved in those groups had great experiences building friendships with Christian adults. But all in all, the house group plan only met with limited success as well. About the time I was thinking of creating another program, I heard Earl Palmer. I don't remember exactly what Earl's message was about, but his comments about growth in the world of nature opened up a whole new book of possibilities for me. He explained that by and large, things grow for only two reasons. Either they are planted — I was quite familiar with planting, putting new things in the ground to see if they would grow — or by being pruned. It had never crossed my mind that I could make my youth ministry grow by getting rid of something. I realized that what I really needed was not to come up with another creative program, but to cut something that I was doing. Since I arrived in Nashville, I had created new program after new program, but I had seldom ever gotten rid of old ones. The multitude of programs were choking each other out, and I was in a jungle. Something was going to go. So I returned to Nashville with a new vision. I had my program hacking machete in my hand, and I began to examine our ministry for one place to cut. Well, the problem was that there was something good about everything we were doing. Youth group had a definite appeal to some. The house groups were meeting a need. I could try to cut Sunday school, but if I was interested in rapid relocation. Clearly, this was not going to be a choice of cutting something bad from the program. That task would have been easy. But I knew our ministry was being choked out by having too many good things. I was also beginning to recognize that our plain old vanilla youth group had hit this invisible ceiling. We were trying to reach such a broad spectrum of young people in that weekly meeting that for the majority, it was not an effective doorway to involvement. So eventually, I settled on getting rid of the Sunday night youth group, a sacred tradition in most southern churches. More than any of our other programs, it was simply going nowhere, and it was becoming increasingly difficult to have a program that would be meaningful both for the Mother Teresa's and the Al Capone's of our group. You know what I'm talking about. At the same time, I was beginning to develop some preliminary ideas about family-based youth ministry. My initial research confirmed over and over again that the real power for faith formation was not in the youth program, but in families and the extended families of the church. Now, I got to tell you, the idea of nuking our Sunday night youth group was not immediately embraced by everyone in the congregation. A group of parents lobbied strongly for the status quo. My colleagues and the church staff kept giving me those looks, I'm so sorry you're going to the gallows looks. And the rumor began to be circulated around town that we'd simply given up our youth ministry because no one came anymore. But for 2 years, we actually did go without a Sunday night youth group, and we lived to tell about it. By the end of our second year, the weekly attendance had increased to almost 60 teenagers. Since we now had only one weekly youth program, Sunday school, instead of three or four, we were able to increase significantly both the quality of our programming and the number of people involved. And it felt to the kids like, hey, everybody's coming. It was basically, there's a few more kids than we were involving, but basically the same kids that were involved in a number of different things came together and felt like they were a part of a single significant ministry. We began to use Sunday nights primarily focusing on special events for the six different classes. For example, one Sunday night, the 10th graders would go to the soup kitchen. The next Sunday, the 9th graders and their parents would go ride go-karts. That structure allowed for flexibility in scheduling without the expectation that every student had to be involved every week. So in addition, a few youth-initiated discipleship groups started to meet on Sunday afternoons. It was fascinating that once we cut our Sunday night youth group, kids began coming to us and saying, could you lead a Bible study for us on Sunday night? Could we have our own small group? And because it grew out of their own initiative, and because they knew that the purpose, they were focused on what the purpose of being a community of faith was, they began to ask for the things that they knew we needed and that they needed. Of course, not everyone was pleased, and many were quite vocal about their concerns. During these years, it seemed as if I spent every youth committee meeting defending our current programming and arguing about whether we should go back to having traditional youth group. Well, by the middle of the second year, I began to realize a tremendous, unexpected byproduct of our minimal programming. I now had a huge group of parents more eager to be involved than ever. Without knowing quite how I had gotten there, I was now exactly where I wanted to be, with a group of enthusiastic parents willing to invest in our youth ministry. Now, a bit of a warning, if you try this at home, one of the things that happens is that the enthusiasm, the energy of the parents often looks like anger. And it often is, it looks as if it is directed in my direction. But much of that was their protective instinct, wanting to make sure that their children were getting the sort of Christian nurture that they needed. As 1992 began, I started to meet weekly with an incredible group of eight parents and one great-grandparent who went to work with a passion to create a broad-based vision for our youth ministry. After a combined 200 hours of work, the group made an extensive 30-page recommendation. Okay, we are Presbyterians. That provided for significant involvement by both parents and teenagers in the ongoing planning process for our ministry. They designed a flexible program that did not lock us into any one activity for too long. The heart of the story really is not what our program looks like now, and I have to tell you that since the time of writing Family-Based Youth Ministry and now, we've changed our formats four or five times. The point really is much more the infusion of whatever we're doing with a significant input and involvement, collaboration with adults. What I said when I wrote the book, and it was a fulfilled prophecy now, I said, I don't want to tell you what the program looks like now because it, by the time the book goes to print, we will have changed the format again. That's absolutely true. The answer is not found in any one structure then, but in the process of creating the structure. You see, the very process of bringing together young people and adults to decide what are we going to do, what's our youth ministry going to look like, all of a sudden, the young people have to collaborate, have to problem solve with those adults. So if I had to give a broad brush kind of strategy, and we can certainly talk about at the end of the course an implementation strategy, or that may be a particular project for you to work on yourself. But I want to give two broad priorities, programmatic priorities, of building family-based youth ministry, and what I call a twofold strategy. When I left the church in Texas where I served in youth ministry for 6 years, the teenagers and their parents decided to have a celebration, a roast, for my wife Susan and me. As is expected at such events, people spoke warmly from their vast store of selective memories about the success of our youth ministry. I'm putting that in quotation. I remember that I wrote a final article in the newsletter that helped me focus more clearly on what success in youth ministry really looked like. In that article, I explained that we really wouldn't know how successful our program had been for 10 years or so. The question is, would these young people still be growing in Christ? Would they have chosen to be proactive Christians, taking initiative in knowing and serving God? I knew that all of our exciting programs would be missed in the wind unless we'd given our teenagers something that lasted. It's now over 15 years since almost 15 years since I left Waco. And almost without exception, those young people who are growing in their faith as adults were teenagers who fit into one of two categories. One, they came from families where Christian growth was modeled in at least one of their parents. Or two, they developed significant connections with adults in the church such significant connections that it had become an extended family for them. I often in seminars, I will ask the group of youth leaders, how many of you came from homes in which at least one of your parents were Christians? I've never had a group that less than 75% did not raise their hands, and often it's 95 or 100%. Interesting, the incredible influence of parents. Not to say that the parents do it all, but there is a clear correlation between parents who are growing in their own faith and adults, the children who grow to be adults and growing in their faith. One of the things that I've seen as I've looked back on the Waco situation was that how often young people attended youth events, that's Sunday school, discipleship groups, retreats, was not a good predictor of whether those teenagers would grow toward mature Christian adulthood. When a church makes its first priority in its youth ministry simply attracting teenagers, those churches will choose almost exclusively to hire young, single, enthusiastic, good-looking adults as youth workers. Now, typically, that strategy works beautifully in the short run. But I agree with Ben Patterson when he argues that young Christians need more. Ben says, a 20-year-old youth worker may be effective in getting kids' attention, but he or she often isn't able to bridge the gap between kids and the adult community, primarily because the youth worker isn't yet a full member of that adult community himself or herself. That's not the youth worker's fault. It is, however, a serious limitation. The beginning of a family-based youth ministry, I'm finished with Ben now. Beginning of a family-based youth ministry involves a shift in perception. Our goal is no longer simply to have a strong youth program. I want to underline that. The goal of family-based youth ministry is not to have a strong youth program. That is, have many teens active in many activities. When, for example, having a Sunday night youth group was not helping our teenagers move to Christian adulthood, our church chose to get rid of that regular event, even if it meant weakening the youth program. This is such a key principle to understand, and particularly for the leadership of the church to understand, that our ministry is far beyond creating a youth program that appears successful. What we are in the business of doing is doing whatever it takes to lead our young people to Christian adulthood. There's a startling study done by the United Church in Australia documenting the long-term impact of dividing the church into age-specific groups. The researchers discovered that people who grew up in church attending worship and not in Sunday school were much more likely to be in church as adults than those who attended only the grade level, the stratified sort of only your age group activities. The results of that study clearly call into question our tunnel vision kind of focus on creating a successful youth ministry. If this conclusion is transferable to Christians in other nations, and I would assume it is, there really is no such thing as a successful youth ministry that isolates its teenagers from the community of faith. Okay, let's talk about this twofold strategy now. The first priority, number one, is empowering parents. Our isolated youth programs cannot compete with the formative power of the family. Over and over again, I've seen this pattern. Young people pull away from their parents' faith during their teenage years, but as a general rule, as adults, they return to the tracks that were laid by their parents. Now, I pictured in a diagram that you can find on page 65 of Family-Based Youth Ministry. Basically, there is if you imagine a canal or a channel that moves young people from birth to maturity in Christ or mature Christian adulthood. The teenage years are just a few years in the middle. They're just 6 years in the middle. Often during the teenage years, there's a pulling away, like a rubber band, a pulling away from the track that's been laid down by their parents. But frequently what happens is that, just like a rubber band, it comes back as they move into adulthood. I clearly pulled away from my parents' faith during my teenage years. Interestingly, I did it by becoming more spiritual than they were. I was sure that because I carried my Bible more often than they did, that I took it, that I took the Bible and my faith more seriously than my Presbyterian minister father and my missionary mother. During my college years especially, I stretched as far as I could to get away from the traditional Christianity they practiced. But now, interestingly enough, I find myself as a minister in the very same denomination as my father, in a church very similar in style to those he served. And I recognize that my pulling away, much of it was only temporary. And although there are significant differences between my faith and my parents' faith, most of those differences, incidentally, will have to do with priority two, which is a connection to an extended family, extended Christian family. For the most part, I've returned to the core Christian values of my own family. Like a rubber band, young people may stretch away from their parents' values during their teenage years, but when they become adults, they're ordinarily returned to the core values of their parents. Now, these parents need help in learning how to provide for the Christian nurture of their children. But youth workers must not merely do for youth what Christian parents cannot or will not do for them. Instead, we must endeavor to equip the parents to communicate the faith children themselves. I would venture to guess that a simple ritual of a dinnertime prayer will have more impact on a young person's ultimate faith maturity as they move to adulthood than all the programs the youth ministry may have. That may be hyperbole, but I think there's something to that. A simple ritual at home is going to have a more powerful influence than so much that we do in creating programs. Equipping parents for their work as the primary nurturers of their children's faith has been an essentially untapped resource in youth ministry. Churches can learn to be just as intentional about equipping parents as they are about developing programs for children and youth. And again, the last chapter, session that we do is just going to be a collection of ideas for beginning this process. Okay, priority number two. The first priority is equipping parents to provide for the Christian nurture of their children. Priority number two is equipping the extended family of the church. The isolation of American teenagers may be a symptom of the rootlessness of the American family. Many parents, in a desire to build security for their children, have chosen to isolate their family into a world of its own, a world in which, the popular phrase, our family comes first. But this family comes first attitude, especially among Christians, has in fact only served to sever nuclear families from the very structures that can give their children lasting values and clear identity. Without strong ties to a specific extended family, for example, the church or the neighborhood or the nation, nuclear families have become self-perpetuating breeding grounds for rootlessness and alienation. It's important to remember that Jesus redefined the nature of the family function, placing a high priority on the extended family of brothers and sisters in Christ. You remember when he was told that his mother and his brother were outside looking for him? He could have said, "My family comes first. I need to go." But instead he responded, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" He looked around at the people sitting with him, and he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my mother, is my brother and sister and mother." In even more radical terms, Jesus challenged his listeners to resist the natural temptation to place family loyalty on a par with loyalty to God. He said, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brother and sisters, yes, and even life itself, cannot be my disciple." Of course, Jesus was not advocating a wholesale rejection of the nuclear family. His concern is that those who follow him must understand clearly the nature of the first family. The unswerving priority, the ultimate priority of the Christian, is the glory of God and his kingdom. Sometimes the nuclear family will support these priorities, and other times it will not. The standard by which the nuclear family is to be judged is not by the new family. The standard by which the nuclear family is to be judged is by the new family of brothers and sisters in Christ. In his book, The First Urban Christians, Wayne Meeks points out that one of the most stinging critiques that the ancient Romans made about Christianity was that it destroyed the family. There was no more cherished value in Roman society than the family. Every Roman institution depended on it. The Romans rightly understood that the Christian faith was a threat to the family, because Christianity advocated the subordination of family loyalty to one's loyalty to the new Christian family. So the second priority of family-based youth ministry must be to provide a new, quote, first family for our teenagers by allowing them to experience the extended family of the church. Not to be confused with an extended family of teenagers in the church. When I was working in Waco, we had a youth group, and we called it Teenage Family. And there was a lot of intimacy and a lot of great sharing there. But the one thing that we missed was the connection with an extended family. The great part, the one saving grace, was that we had the senior minister there every week talking to the kids. But eventually I saw that the senior minister being there foolishly, I said the senior minister there doesn't fit with our plan for what we want to do with our kids, and we need to have a more structured program. And at that point, we asked the senior minister to do something else, which he was, of course, happy to do. It is so easy for us to say, let's just create a teenage family. Let's create a family of young people together. And certainly intimacy is often much easier and comes much quicker in that sort of environment. But it also leaves much easier as well. It is an orphaning structure. What about young people who don't come from Christian homes? That is a question that I am asked almost every time I do a family-based youth ministry seminar. How can you say we need to build on families and extended family of the church? What about kids that don't come from Christian homes? Aren't we losing them? Well, in many ways, I think family-based youth ministry has more benefits for those whose parents are outside the church than does traditional youth ministry. Youth who come from non-Christian homes especially need a circle of adult Christians to model the Christian life for them. These teenagers need more than their youth leaders, even more than the young people from Christian homes. They need a secure, lifelong structure that a connection to an entire church provides. A retired Air Force pilot reminiscing to young people about his fearful and faith-demanding flights in World War II may seem just like an old man telling stories. In other words, it may not fit in our curriculum plan. But those stories can be the gospel made real. Good news with skin on it. As youth hear adults speaking of their own faith experiences, they begin to learn how to describe their own experience of God. There are many ways for adults to be with teenagers without being their teachers. One of the churches I described in Chapter 1 was accomplished in this goal, quite successfully, without even knowing it. That Texas pastor, you remember he lamented that his church had virtually no youth program. But in his small church, 15 out of 18 young people were active in some program of the church weekly. They were ushering or singing in the adult choir, helping in the nursery, or teaching children Sunday school. That church had, without even planning to do so, created multiple opportunities for its young people to be influenced by Christian adults in the church. If this church is ever to create a successful youth program, it may destroy its youth ministry. Well, I want to talk about three models for youth ministry. And actually, I have begun now over the years as I do this presentation. I often present 15 different models for ministry, and then I call these three that I'll talk about now paradigms. Every church has got to pick the lens through which they're going to do their youth ministry. And I find that these three paradigms have been very liberating, not easy, because they call us to make a decision. I'm going to give you three choices. And most churches wallow into the third choice, which is one I wouldn't recommend for anyone because it always ends in frustration. Most churches end up there because they're simply afraid to make a decision. Because to decide means to cut off other options. Okay, let's talk about these three. I'm going to call them here. I'll try to consistently call them paradigms. And then I'll talk a bit about models when we finish that. In struggling to determine what to do about our ministry with teenagers, I discovered that most churches are frustrated with their youth programs. Not only are church leaders not getting what they want, but those same leaders can't seem to agree on what exactly it is that they want. As I looked for churches who were doing youth ministry effectively, I discovered a distinct pattern. Every church I looked at was using one of three distinct models. I've not seen a youth program yet that does not fit into one of these three categories. The principles of family-based youth ministry can be implemented in any one of the three. And I want to make the case, of course, that family-based youth ministry principles need to undergird whatever kind of model we have, but we need to decide and be aware of what the model is that we're actually using. Either of the first two can be quite effective. The third is a model used by the majority of churches and almost always results in a sense of frustration and failure. Okay, the first one. I call this first one Fortune 500, or perhaps the Walmart model. In a Fortune 500 program, the congregation and the church expect excellence in everything. Great communication, great pastoral care, great student leadership, great missions, great education, great volunteer recruitment and training, great youth music program, excellence in everything. The favorite phrase heard around the Fortune 500 youth ministry is, "We can do it better." This model of ministry, or this paradigm of ministry, has many advantages. It tends to produce a high-quality, visible program with teenagers involved in very creative programming. The church becomes known around the community as a church that makes ministry to youth a real priority. But one disadvantage of this kind of programming is that the high-level programming may inadvertently train the youth of the church to be good consumers, to demand superior programming, demand a superior product before pursuing their faith as adults. The other disadvantage is that this type of program is fairly expensive. According to my rough estimates, based on general research of churches with this style of program, a church can expect to pay between $1,500 and $2,000 for each student active in the program on a weekly basis. In general, the principle for, as I've estimated, is the smaller churches tend to be able to do this. Churches under 500 members tend to be able to do it a little bit cheaper than the $1,500 to $2,000. But in general, that's a good rule of thumb to go by. In other words, if a church wants a Fortune 500 program with 100 teens involved every week, it would cost that church $150,000 or to $200,000, with the majority of the budget would typically go to staffing. A typical Fortune 500 youth ministry has a large full-time youth ministry staff, usually between 3 and 8 full-time workers. And some of these churches have extensive intern programs with scores of paid workers investing in the youth of the church. Again, what I like to do is to present to my the board or whoever the decision makers are, here are your options. Now, I can lead or I can work in any of these options, but let's decide which one we want to do. Okay, the second. The second is called Stick to Your Knitting. This type of program revolves around a single element of the youth ministry. It might be evangelism. It might be Bible study. It might be Sunday school. The church simply chooses, intentionally or accidentally, what it will focus its ministry to teenagers in. And they'll try to it'll try to focus on one thing and do that one thing very well. Around churches that have a stick-to-your-knitting style of youth ministry, the favorite phrase is, "We may not be able to do everything, but we have a great whatever." The advantage of this kind of program is that it can be much less expensive than a Fortune 500 model while involving just as many young people. Teens are likely to feel involved on a deeper level if they're invested in a single program rather than dabbling in a variety of events. Of course, the single disadvantage to stick to your knitting, or what I would call the Starbucks coffee model. When you go to Starbucks, you know what they do well is coffee. Now, they sell mugs and they sell some desserts and some other things, but basically what they do is coffee, right? The singular disadvantage of the Starbucks or stick-to-your-knitting model is that it may lack the balance that teenagers need as they're developing a clear understanding of the Christian life. Young people could easily come to equate the whole of the Christian life with the single focus of the youth ministry. For example, a church who's knitting their Starbucks, their coffee, is the youth choir, may find that for some young people, the choir it sums up their entire faith identity. Or a church that makes missions the primary emphasis may neglect worship or Christian education or discipleship. Now, two examples. The Fellowship of Christian Athletes and Youth with a Mission are two ministries that have developed this model of youth ministry well. Both of the groups have a single focus and have emerged from the youth ministry confusion of the 80s with a consistently growing ministry to teenagers. Now, I'm often asked, when I ask groups to decide, which do you want to be? Do you want to be a Fortune 500 or a stick to your knitting? People often say, well, can't you pick more than one? My answer always is, you're sure welcome to. I've never seen it happen successfully before, but you're sure welcome to try. My thinking is that that we can do other things. When I say you do just like Starbucks, you don't just sell coffee, but that is, and you may not even make all your money off of coffee, but that is the thing that you're known for, the place you put your focus. And, for example, if your model, let me give you just a few examples of models. If your model is retreats, and you say, we're going to focus on having, your paradigm would be stick to your knitting, your model is retreats. You would say, we're going to have four or five really effective retreats this year in our youth ministry. That's what we do well. We do retreats. And everything you do in Sunday school and on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights, everything you do would either point toward planning that retreat, getting people to go on the retreat, whatever, or be a processing of what we decided on the trip. How are we going to live out our faith from that retreat? Okay, that's one model. Another model may be missions. You may focus the entire year around, we're going to send every one of our kids on a mission somewhere this year. So you'll be focusing on fundraising. You'll be focusing on doing study about missions and what God's call to is in mission. But the idea is that everything would focus toward that single goal of we're going to get all our kids involved in missions this year. Maybe your model is student leadership. Ray Johnson has a great little book about student leadership. Basically, the idea is that every young person in the church would be involved in a leadership responsibility in some very intentional way. They may be on the music team or the audiovisual team or the drama team or the puppet team or the setup team or the tear down clean team or the food team, whatever. Every kid has a specific responsibility, a specific role that they play. And again, in that model, the idea is that every kid is tied in some way to using their gifts. Now, what I've noticed about most youth ministry books is that they're built on a single model. And any of those models work really fine if you choose to use only that model. The problem is that most of us usually read more than one youth ministry book. And so we tend to create some sort of hybrid combination of different models, and we wonder, why isn't mine working the way they said it would work in the book? Now, the difference between those models and family-based youth ministry is that family-based youth ministry is something that would undergird whatever model you do. I'm not advocating any particular model. I'm just saying make a decision, and whatever decision you make, undergird that by empowering parents and connecting kids to significant adults in the church. One other point of clarification in terms of models, one possible model that you might use, and this is potentially confusing, one possible model is family-based programming. That's not the same as the undergirding family-based youth ministry. In other words, you may say, what we're going to do is focus everything we do on intergenerational programming. That's going to be the one thing that we do best, and focus on doing that very well. And many of the ideas in this book can help you do that. My church does not have family-based programming as its model because we are more of a Fortune 500 company, a Fortune, a Walmart kind of paradigm that we're using. But churches that are stick to your knitting may choose to do family-based programming as their model. And there are many others, and certainly you just look at the youth ministry shelves, different kind of models you're going to find all around there. Okay, let me talk about the third possible paradigm. what I call comparative confusion, or if we're still using business analogies, this would be the going out of business sale. No model can provide everything. And any model, again, I'm sorry to use these terms interchangeably. Let me call this paradigm. No paradigm can provide everything. And any paradigm that a church chooses for its youth ministry is going to have disadvantages. But while either of the first two paradigms will work effectively if the strategy is fully embraced, most churches, in an unrealistic effort to avoid the disadvantages, opt for a youth ministry with no clear vision at all. They then almost inevitably fall into a model I call comparative confusion, the worst of all possible choices. The church with a comparative confusion youth ministry places great demands on its youth program. These demands are not based on what's realistic for the church, considering its budget. Rather, the expectations are based on the fact that not enough teenagers are involved in the church, while other churches seem to be reaching young people more successfully. The favorite question of the comparative confusion church is, why can't we just do what they're doing at that other church? Since the focus is not set, this style of programming has the apparent advantage of flexibility and the potential for constant change. But leaders in comparative confusion youth ministries have difficulty acknowledging or enjoying their own accomplishments, as long as other churches seem to be doing anything more. Now, the obvious disadvantage is that this, and there are no advantages, there's only the apparent advantage of flexibility. It's a flexibility that is, it's sort of like the flexibility that a rudderless ship has. It can go wherever the wind blows it, but it's not going to make very good time going anywhere in particular. The obvious disadvantage is that this model produces a perpetual attitude of frustration and failure. When the identity of a program is based solely on how it compares with other churches, frustration almost always results. Does a church across town have a great youth choir? Well, a comparative church, confusion church, would work like crazy to stay competitive. Whether it's concerts or small groups or mission or the latest youth ministry fad, the comparative confusion youth ministry remains in a reactive posture, responding to the loudest voices or the priorities of the newest staff or volunteers. This model prevents churches from ever sticking to any one priority long enough to let it work. Because of the constant sense of failure that's a part of this style of ministry, the comparative confusion church can expect a rapid turnover in youth workers, and they often do. Family-based youth ministry works best with either of the first two models, though it can work with comparative confusion. A Fortune 500 youth ministry needs the undergirding that comes from involving families in the extended family church. A stick-to-your-knitting youth ministry would be wise to approach its single priority from a family-based perspective, undergirding everything it does with a family-based approach. The key is that the church become intentional about choosing its model for youth ministry and then undergird that model with some family-based programming. Some family-based philosophy would breathe through whatever model that you choose. Okay, we're going to, next time, on the next tape, we'll talk some about the difference between this foundational focus in family-based youth ministry and the idea of a programmatic focus. Family-based youth ministry, one of the frustrations that people have as they have read the book and heard me teach, is that there is no manual for how you create a family-based program, because it is simply a breathing into. It is like a the circulatory system in the body. It is a breathing into the entire body, health and undergirding. So whatever the program is, this foundational model would breathe into the rest of the body. So we'll talk about that as we start next time. Blessings on you.